Hello and welcome to DNA Design and Architecture. I'm Frances Anderton. On today's show, we'll visit the 21st century's answer to Santa's workshop, Otis College Department of Toy Design, and we'll go design shopping with David Keats, the Scout. But first, some residents of New Orleans may have received their best possible Christmas present, the promise of a new home. Since Katrina wiped out much of New Orleans, many architects and planners from inside and outside the city have produced creative plans for rebuilding. But over 2 years later, much of the city is still devastated. Now, Brad Pitt has joined with a non-profit developer and planners to create Make It Right. The idea is to build 150 homes in the low-lying Lower Ninth Ward. They're intended for homeowners who had lost their homes and couldn't afford to rebuild. They're to be built on the existing lots and to be funded by a mix of non-profit loans, charitable donations, and owner contributions. Owners will choose from 13 house designs, and these won't be regular designs. Brad Pitt is known to be fascinated by architecture and intends Make It Right to showcase innovative design solutions. Here's Brad Pitt earlier this month on CNN.
What we did is we called in 13 of the best minds in architecture that could take on sustainability, affordability, safety, because this will flood again, and still be true to the aesthetic nature of the culture.
So who are these 13 best minds? They're drawn from Europe, America, Africa and Japan, as well as New Orleans. They include leading names like Shigeru Ban, David Adjaye and Tom Main. Several come from LA. And how did they respond to the narrow lots, the wet, hot climate, the flood risk, and the house types of New Orleans, the shotgun, the camelback, and the Creole cottage? Alejandro Lillo is a partner at Graf Los Angeles. That's the firm that created a vivid pink installation at the site called the Pink House Project that's intended to draw attention and funds to Make It Right. They also helped create the guidelines for the future houses.
We asked the architects to incorporate passive survivability strategies. These included a safe haven, emergency storage, valuable storage, the elevation of the house to be within 5 to 8 feet, and waterproofing materials so that should Katrina or a similar event occur again, we would be prepared. We also asked the architects to incorporate a number of sustainability features. These obviously included things like solar panels, water catchment systems, geothermal systems, tankless water heaters, low-flow toilets. We included sort of strategies for high ceilings with stacked ventilations, as well as operable windows, which would aid in cross-ventilation. We required that all of these houses meet LEED certifications, for example, no off-gassing paints, permeable pavements. The list goes on.
So what kind of designs did the architects come up with? First, let's hear from Tom Main, the LA architect who's known for fiercely modern buildings like Caltrans in downtown and the new federal building in San Francisco.
The local community there, they don't want modern architects. I mean, most people don't want modern architects. If they build a house, they choose one. And there's very few, actually, in this country. And so we decided from the get-go that the building would look more or less like they want it to look like, and they can choose that. And so we developed a building that was self-sustainable. It produces its own electricity. It collects its own water. It has its onboard waste system, and it comes as a chassis, literally like a chassis of a car. And then you put the body on, and it floats.
The architects also drew from the traditions of the community. Here's Larry Scarpa of the LA firm Pew Plus Scarpa, which is known for imaginative, affordable and green multifamily housing. While abstract in its appearance, his house design nonetheless draws on local tradition.
Well, the key thing would be how people actually use the house. What's really important is in New Orleans, and particularly in the Ninth Ward, that there's a real connection to the community. The street is alive and people know each other. So, you know, we've made a place which actually opens to the street, which opens to the outside. Our project has a porch that is on the south side, but it's shaded. It has this wall that is a light filter, where on the north side, it's exposed directly to the elements. And the plan itself, it has the porch. It has a courtyard space, so it is in some ways a modified shotgun house.
Another architect proposes going to even deeper traditions. That's Joe Addo of Constructs, who spent many years in LA before returning to his native Ghana and developing an architectural approach that he calls Inno-Native, mixing African tradition with contemporary design.
The African Americans in the South are direct descendants of African slaves. I really want to imbue this, at least my side of the project, with these linkages. And this would be expressed in things like even the materiality. You know, if you look at, you know, as a metaphor, how the water, you know, the floods came through and then they receded, leaving all these layers of alluvial silt and all that. Why don't we make adobe blocks out of this stuff? There's a connection to the earth.
Some of the architects involved in Make It Right are noted for very distinctive buildings, so distinctive they're sometimes labelled starkitecture by critics. In fact, the Make It Right house designed by Dutch firm MVRDV screams wacky architect. But most of the designers sublimated their egos, says Steve Dumez, partner in the New Orleans-based firm Eskew Dumez Ripple.
The residents were first and foremost. And each time we would meet and present the work, there would be that kind of give and take. And I would say that most designs evolved pretty significantly over the course of time based upon that resident feedback.
One of the Lower Ninth Ward residents who offered feedback is a community activist named Vanessa Geringer. How did she feel about the Make It Right process?
It was exciting for them to come to the community and be sensitive to our needs and our vision for what we wanted our neighborhood to look like was great.
And what about the house designs?
Well, some of the houses are somewhat modernistic for this area because everybody's used to shotgun houses, Creole cottages. But I think it's a bold move for us to step out and to have something new in our community that doesn't look like what's the mainstay here. So I think, you know, it's wonderful.
The Lower Ninth Ward has needs that architecture alone cannot fulfill, like better jobs and schools. It needs new sewers and electricity lines. It faces more floods. But Vanessa Geringer is sure that 150 well-designed homes in the Lower Ninth Ward can be a model for the revival of New Orleans.
To have a cluster of houses in a place that everyone else in the city, our mayor, our city council, and everyone else said, you know, you shouldn't put houses there because you shouldn't even go back to this area, you know. So our vision was to repopulate this area, you know. And like I said, building these houses, these designs, they're different, they're bold. And we need something like that, you know, that says, you know, we're coming back and we're coming back better, you know, than we ever were before.
If you want to know more about Make It Right and the house designs, go to makeitrightnola.org. That's makeitrightnolaallruntogether.org. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA on 89.9 KCRW and kcrw.com. Later in the show, we'll go design store shopping with the Scout. But now, a visit to Santa's workshop, 21st century style.
Hi, I'm Samantha George, and I'm a sophomore at Otis College of Art and Design. I'm working on my rescue hero project, and this is the sidekick. It's going to be a dragon that goes with this rescue hero. Her story behind her is that she was raised by dragons, and she rescues fantasy creatures.
My name is Steve Guerra. I'm a sophomore toy designer. At this moment, I'm actually working on a plush toy design, cutting out the pattern pieces for my little plush toy, which is going to be a detachable robot, because it's going to have Velcro on the head and the mid-body, and you can switch them with different bodies.
My name is Jessica Miranda. Right here, I'm working on a rescue hero. It's Chavant, which is a kind of clay that we've been using to sculpt. His name's Diver Dan, and his sidekick here is an octopus.
If you look at what makes our industry so interesting is it's a bunch of people that are usually adults designing toys for preschoolers and above, but there's billions of dollars involved. Anytime you have that situation, things have to happen in certain ways. They have to. The idea is don't lose the fun of it. There's nothing like being a designer and seeing a kid throw himself on the floor of a Toys R Us or a Target or somewhere like that and refuse to go another step until his mom buys your toy. Let me tell you, that's one of the biggest rushes of my life.
You just heard from three sophomores in the toy department of Otis College of Art and Design and their teacher, Mark Taylor, a longtime inventor of toys. We've all heard a lot about toys recently, most of it bad news about recalls. But while toys may mostly be made overseas, many are designed here in LA, home of the entertainment industry, and companies like Mattel that will hire these young Geppettos straight out of Otis. So how are toys designed? Deborah Ryan is chair of the toy department. And just tell us, what are we looking at in the wall, on the walls here and displayed in these glass cases?
We are looking at our gallery. That's where we display the work of students that represents the different categories of toy design that we teach here. There's quite a variety, everything from plush to preschool to vehicles, action figures, games, quite a few different categories that we teach.
What is plush?
Plush are stuffed animals, bears and all kinds of fun little furry things. So
Mark, why don't you just single out a couple of examples, just describe them and, you know, tell us how they represent these departments.
In back of us here is from the action figure class, and they're basically little heroes that boys play with, or girls, and it allows them to express their imagination. It encourages them to get excited about being empowered as a human being and being empowered about what the future possibly could have. It's not necessarily violent. It can be funny. It can be anything. But it's all about imagination. If it doesn't inspire a child's imagination, it's really not working as a toy.
This is a world of toys that's very different from, say, building blocks or Legos. Can you talk about this world that we're in of toys?
Well, in the past, toys were not so much into branding, and now they are so tied into licensing and branding and because of television and film. For instance, in the past, 20 years ago, Mark designed Masters of the Universe. He designed He-Man. He brought it to Mattel, and it became a toy line. Then it became a comic strip and an animated series, and it grew from there. That very seldom happens in that way anymore, unfortunately. It usually starts with the release of a movie or a television show or a character at a theme park.
I was interested to read, actually, in the Otis brochure talking about the toy department, that in Europe there's more of an idea of handing on toys down to the next generation, and whereas here there's more of a sort of built-in obsolescence. Toys are made, thrown away, a new one comes in next year.
In Europe, people actually look at the quality of the toy. They see how it's made. They're very concerned about how long it's going to last. It's obvious that in this country it's more fad-driven. That's kind of the nature of our culture. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't aspire to do these marvelous, eternal toys, toys that just don't seem to go away. I have a lot of respect for the Legos. I have a lot of respect for the Tonka companies, for some of the really well-engineered toys. Hot Wheels has been around for a long time. These are because they have a basic, solid play pattern, very important, and that they have appeal on the shelf.
What is play pattern?
Play pattern is actually when you get down to what it's all about. That's where it's the kid and the toy and how they interact with each other.
For little girls, particularly with dolls, a big play pattern is hair play, dress up. That isn't the same with an action figure. That's empowerment, good versus evil. That's, you know, more of a boy play pattern, but not anymore because girls are empowered and strong.
As you know, there's been so many recalls recently. Also, there's this other and related issue, which is a growing concern about sustainability. Are those themes that you're wrapping into your education about toy design?
Yes, we are interested in that, and we see that as a trend in society. You brought up the point about obsolescence, planned obsolescence. I think everyone on the planet is beginning to be aware of the fact that how many plastic toys can we put in a landfill. I think the recalls are really a good thing because we won't be counting on someone else to make sure that things are safe. We won't be counting on the China or someone else to have that responsibility. We'll have checks and balances here.
It's my personal observation that the toy industry of the recent past was unfortunately more interested in dollar sales. The process has changed a lot because it's the fashion industry to just-in-time shipping, to going for the maximum margin. The thing that has to happen to get back people's confidence, the trade's confidence, that means the retailer's confidence, is to show them definite milestones where there's a check done in for their benefit, for the benefit of the end user, the children, and for the benefit of all concerned. Those checks used to be very well spelled out in the milestones of the process. They've become blurred lately because they slow everything down a little bit.
And lastly, Deborah, what was your favorite toy as a child, and what inspired you to become a designer?
My favorite toy when I was growing up was a Barbie doll. It inspired me to create clothing for her, and ultimately, I ended up becoming a designer at Mattel and designing clothes for Barbie. And
was it a dream come true?
It was a dream come true, and it led me to other areas of toy design, and that's been a very lucrative and fulfilling career for me.
Mark?
My favorite toys, I hate to be a drag, was a paper and pencil, because I loved to draw for as long as I can remember. And to recreate the Prince Valiant or the Tarzan, three-dimensional toys, I would take clay and build dinosaurs. I've been in this business for as long as I can remember. I've been building my toys.
But then you're raising a contradiction here, Mark, because what gave you great pleasure as a child was creating something from nothing. What you as a toy designer are doing is creating the toys for other children to play with that is taking out the creative role for them.
No, in fact, just the opposite. My dream would be to do toys that would start them creating and constantly add impetus so that they would do that. If I could do the perfect toy, it would be a toy that the child would take and then do wonderful, marvelous things with.
Mark Taylor and Deborah Ryan, thank you so much. This has been so interesting.
Well, thank you. It's been interesting speaking with you.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Deborah Ryan is chair of the toy department at Otis College of Art and Design. Mark Taylor is adjunct professor in the toy department at Otis College of Art and Design. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. After this break, we'll go design shopping with the Scout, and we'll get an interesting view from the Griffith Observatory.
KCRW supporters include JR Manufacturing, fabricator and installer of custom-made countertops, featuring Silestone antimicrobial protected countertops and other quality countertop materials, serving the Southland since 1954. 626-579-5300 or jayarmanufacturing.com.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. In a moment, Juan Angelino's view from the Griffith Observatory. But first, continuing our holiday season theme, let's talk about gift giving for design buffs. And I'm very delighted to be able to talk about how to do that in the best and most interesting way with David A. Keeps. He's staff writer in the home section of the LA Times. He's author of their weekly column, The Scout, also hosted the Ovation TV series, Art and the City. Welcome, David.
Thank you for having me on DNA.
I just wanted you to just give us a little bit of a look back over the last year, because there's been a bit of a design boom going on in LA, and a number of shops sort of came to town, some of them with a big load of fanfare like Moss, some of them quieter, but just tell us, to start with, about the new design shops in L.A.
Well, you're absolutely right. One of the biggest arrivals in Los Angeles was the store Moss, which has, for a long time in New York, been the leading sort of proponent of creating the museum experience for modern design and contemporary design. Moss is very curated, and it's an experience that you get where you actually go in and you not really are looking at lamps so much as works of art. The way that everything is staged in the store very much gives you the impression that this is important design. They're staged in glass cases or in museum-like vignettes. It's very cutting edge.
Let's talk about some of the stores that also came to town or are new that are possibly sell stuff that's a little bit more accessible.
Well, on the a little bit more accessible range, there's a store called A Plus R, which just opened a new outlet in Venice on Abbot Kinney. Abbot Kinney is a particularly great location if you are looking for new things that aren't astronomically expensive. What I like about A Plus R is they do a lot of smaller things for the home, and that they really curate, in the same way that Moss does, but on a smaller scale, they curate new designs from up-and-coming people all over Europe.
Now, the two stores we've just talked about are striking contemporary design, but you've observed some other areas of design out there that are being marketed in a very interesting way.
Well, you know, the vintage market is huge in Los Angeles, and there are many, many stores that open and stay open and thrive for years and years and years and have done since the 90s, really. And what I'm seeing now is there are a lot of interior designers, even house flippers, people who have amassed a huge amount of vintage furniture and accessories, and they have opened storefronts within their design practices. I call them ateliers, where you can go in and see what the interior designer's taste is by seeing the objects that they have, and you can also buy a piece of it. There's a number of people who are doing that very successfully. One of the ones that I find most intriguing is Suzanne Fellman, and she is on a very tiny street called South Cloverdale off of Wilshire. And Suzanne does quarterly shows. She just did one with Celia Burtwell, the British textiles designer.
Who was a model for David Hockney.
Exactly. Amazing, amazing thing. She has these horse heads made out of feathers. They're giant, like, you know how there's this big thing for taxidermy now, and everybody seems to want to have
a stuffed animal in the living room.
Yeah, everybody wants to have a moose head over their fireplace, even though we live in Los Angeles and there are no moose. It's that kind of modern ski chalet, rustic kind of thing, but this is the most fantastical version of it because it's probably made out of fiberglass or styrofoam or a taxidermy base, and it's all created with feathers, brown feathers, and it's this beautiful horse head with flocked velvet eyes, and it's gorgeous.
The housing market, the writer's strike. Maybe there's a little bit less cash to spend this year. Are there any shops that you're aware of that are really good places to go if you just, you know, would rather not spend so much?
For value,
yes.
As we like to say. Yes.
And imagination.
For value and imagination, there's a place called The Dock. It's called The Dock Downtown, and they do a lot of manufacturer closeouts, and they have a lot of high design items. So that's a really great place to check out for stocking stuffers. I would say generally, if you're on the west side, go to Venice. If you're on the east side, go to Silver Lake. But, you know, from a design point of view, Los Angeles has an incredible wealth of neighborhoods, of vendors, of retailers, of artisans. It's pretty much everywhere you look. And even in the, you know, the outskirts, like I'm quite fond of going to Fair Oaks Boulevard in Pasadena and Mission Street in South Pasadena. There's a store there that recently opened called American Street. And they sell a lot of sort of carnival things and old medical charts and anatomical things and those things you used to they're called circus punks or carnival punks. It's a little figurine that you would throw a softball at and try and tip it over and win a Cupid doll. They probably also sell the Cupid dolls that you used to win as well.
And last but absolutely not least, David, what would you like as a holiday gift, or where would you most like somebody to get something for you?
Well, you know what? I wouldn't be mad if that horse head ended up, you know, I wouldn't want it at the foot of my bed like in the Godfather movies, but I wouldn't be mad at all because it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece.
Well, David, thank you very much for sharing your expertise with us.
My pleasure. I got to go shopping now. I'm stoked.
David A. Keeps is a staff writer for the Home section at the LA Times. He's author of their weekly column, The Scout, and he was host of the Ovation TV series, Art and the City. And finally, we'll hear about a favorite building in LA. My guest is Susan Horowitz. She currently has a show of photographs with Carol Bishop of LA buildings in a state of flux. That's at Hennessy & Ingalls, the design bookstore in Santa Monica. Susan, good to talk to you.
Terrific to talk with you.
And you see a lot of LA buildings, so this is probably a hard one for you to select a favorite. But do you have a favorite building or place in Los Angeles?
I absolutely do. And it's the Griffith Park Observatory. And the reason is that it is a private place for me, although it is a public structure and an iconic public structure at that. I live on Edgemont Street, and I see the observatory every single day when I walk or drive up the street. So it has become an icon for me of what it means to live in Los Angeles.
And what does it mean?
I have found Los Angeles to be an inscrutable place. I'm from New York, and I have found it very difficult to get a handle on what Los Angeles means. And one of the keys, and it's an architectural key, is the observatory. And the way the observatory is a through point from the land of Los Angeles and the views of Los Angeles as a whole and the mountains, I find that it's symbolic. It's beautiful, classical, modern Art Deco. But it's also symbolic of the wealth of architecture that is below, across Los Angeles, but embedded, hard to find and hard to learn about. And I also hike above the observatory, and the views of the city from that standpoint are really important.
So for you to conclude, the observatory is not just an icon in itself, it's what you observe from the observatory. And that isn't really from what you're saying about planets and stars.
No, absolutely not. It's really ironic, I guess, that that is not what's important. It's about being a key to understanding Los Angeles.
Susan Horowitz, it's great to talk to you. That was really interesting.
Thank you so much.
Susan Horowitz currently has a show of photographs together with the artist Carol Bishop that shows LA buildings in a state of flux, and that is on show at Hennessy & Ingalls Design and Art Bookstore in Santa Monica, which I should add is in itself a wonderful destination if you want to find one of the best selections of design and art books in LA. That is Hennessy & Ingalls at 214 Wilshire Boulevard in Santa Monica. That's it for this month's DNA. Thanks very much for listening. The show was produced by Ray Guana with production assistance from Alyssa Walker. The consulting producer is Jennifer Farrow. Thanks to Nan Sherry Lieberman for managing the website. You can listen to today's or past shows anytime by going to kcrw.com/DNA. You can also podcast the show from there or from iTunes. I'm Frances Anderton. Have a great holiday and join me next year for more DNA.